What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Seth Rudetsky, expert on everything having to do with Broadway musicals and host of SiriusXM's Broadway Channel shows Seth's Big Fat Broadway and Seth Speaks. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Too Jewish Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinchinim, Chen Denachi, and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. What is so special about being Jewish? In the Torah, we're told that we are an Am Segula, a unique or chosen people, with a particular mission to be Or LaGoyim, a light to the nations. This has often been interpreted and misinterpreted as a kind of Jewish exceptionalism, even a sense of superiority. We think that somehow we are uniquely gifted or better than other people. In truth, there's a bit of that in Jewish tradition and even some of it in popular perception. We Jews are proud of the fact that our belief in one God is the basis of all monotheism and all Western religion. We understand that the concept of mitzvah and mitzvot, the responsibility to do primary actions because they are right, is at the heart of what it means to be a good person. We believe that our obligation to be stewards of the earth, to work to perfect the world we've been given, requires us to act in ways that seek to benefit not only ourselves or our own people, but the entire human race. We glory in the fact that we identify with the downtrodden, the poor and oppressed, because we're commanded to remember that we began as slaves in Egypt, and we know that we have a special responsibility to help them, for that reason alone. And we Jews know that our people and religion have survived longer than any other in recorded history, striving always to be witnesses to these ideals through our lives and our actions. And yes, we are also more than a little proud of the accomplishments of our people, although we are not numerous. The fact that 22% of all Nobel Prizes ever awarded have been given to Jews, although we're less than 1% of the population of the world. The many extraordinary achievements of Jewish writers, philosophers, scientists, musicians, artists, actors, producers, psychologists, entrepreneurs, inventors, economists, business people, judges, academics, and political leaders. Still, Jewish history has not exactly been a long procession of joyous celebrations of specialness. Instead, it has mostly been a seemingly endless succession of discriminations, persecutions, oppression, exiles, expulsions, tortures, massacres, terrorism, even genocide. We have been wandering Jews throughout history, not so much by choice, but as the result of anti-Semitic hostility. Whatever great successes we have had in some realms, intellectual and cultural and later economic, have mostly been overbalanced by the brutality that the non-Jewish world has so often dished out to us. When asked about Jewish exceptionalism, the notion we are truly special, the first response for many Jews is likely to be borrowed from the great Yiddish author Shalom Aleichem, by way of the Broadway show Fiddler on the Roof. God, I know, we are your chosen people, but once in a while, can't you choose someone else? And yet, in the late 20th and early 21st century, this conception of Jewish chosenness has taken on a different quality. The thriving of the State of Israel, first Jewish nation in almost 2,000 years, and the great freedom and success Jews have enjoyed in America, mostly, but also in other developed nations of the world, has liberated Jews from the direct fear of persecution in most places. We can enjoy the accomplishments of our people without the accompanying legitimate fear of being exiled or destroyed. Although some threats continue to exist, certainly, and we are very sensitive to them, we can feel, well, special, if we wish, part of a people chosen to have a unique mission. But are we Jews really so special? Look, every people and religion thinks it's special, of course, and believes it has qualities and aspects deserving of extraordinary recognition. That's often the basis of the pride people feel about their own identity, whether religious, national, tribal, or otherwise. If you don't believe that your belief system or group is better than others, you likely will not stay with that tradition if you have the option to leave. For example, most Americans think that our country is the best one on earth. Patriotic dwellers in other nations often have similar beliefs about their own countries. Believing Christians and Muslims think their religions are the best, certainly for themselves, perhaps for everyone. Republicans are usually certain their political party is the best one in the U.S., and Democrats believe that they are in the better party. Even supporters of sports teams base their allegiance on a sense of the specialness of their favorite franchise, whether they are Yankees or Patriots fans with endless legacies of success, or Chicago Cubs fans before 2016 with their nearly endless legacy of shared failure. For so long, we Jews were special because we were different, linked together by the legacies of great learning, religious and intellectual accomplishment, and forced together by severe outside oppression and persecution. With the founding of the State of Israel in 1948, and even more with the enduring success of the Jewish state, our sense of specialness takes a new and different turn. Originally, we were chosen by God to fulfill a difficult mission, seeking justice and goodness in a world in which neither ordinarily flourish. We have never lost that ideal. But today, not so encumbered by fear of annihilation, it becomes ever more essential that we seek to fulfill that mission, stand for our principles, and represent them with our actions. Then we truly will represent what it means to be a chosen people. On a much lighter note, and to play us in this morning, here's a Broadway beginning in honor of our guest today, Seth Rudetsky, the unchallenged expert on everything about Broadway musicals from the show Spamalot. You won't succeed on Broadway if you don't have any Jews.
In any great adventure, if you don't want to lose, victory depends upon the people that you choose. So listen, Arthur, darling, closely to this news. We won't succeed on Broadway if we don't have any Jews. You may have the finest sets, fill the stage with penthouse pets. You may have the loveliest costumes and best shoes. You may dance and you may sing, but I'm sorry, Arthur King, you'll hear no cheers, just lots and lots of boos. You may have butch men by the score, whom the audience adore. You may even have some animals from zoos. Though you've poles and krauts instead, you may have unleavened bread, but I tell you, you are dead if you don't have any Jews. They won't care if it's witty or everything looks pretty and refuse. Nobody will go, sir, if it's not kosher, then no show, sir. Even Goyim won't be dim enough to choose. Put on shows that make men stare with lots of girls in underwear. You may even have the finest of reviews.
You're doing great!
But the audiences won't care, sir, as long as you don't dare, sir, to open up on Broadway.
If we don't have any Jews.
Have dramatic lighting, or lots of horrid fighting. You may even have some white men sing the blues. Your knights may be nice boys, but sadly we're all goys, and that noise that you call singing you must lose. So despite your pretty lights and naughty girls in nasty tights, and the most impressive scenery you use, you may have dancing man-a-mano, you may bring on a piano, but they will not give a damn-o if you don't have any Jews.
That was Spamalot's You Won't Succeed on Broadway If You Don't Have Any Jews. Our guest this morning is Seth Rudetsky, Broadway musical maven supreme, who has been a pianist, performer, and most of all, expert on the shows, music, stars, performers, and everything else about the great American musical. Meet him when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
To welcome our guest this morning, here's a bit of that great song from the March of the Falsettos, Everyone Hates His Parents.
Just look at me, I'm world-class traveler each Friday night. Travel, travel, travel from her house to his house. First take the 104 with my computer. I'm just a little kid, not a commuter. And each Sunday night, mother comes to get me and I hear them fight. Everybody's yelling about the bar mitzvah. It's not a wrestling match, why are they sweating? It's not a funeral, what's so upsetting? It's a celebration where I get presents. But everybody's yelling and everybody's ruining it. It's a celebration where I get richer. But everybody's yelling and everybody's ruining it. Everybody's ruining it. Why, oh why? What have I done that they'd ruin my bar mitzvah?
What have I done that they'd ruin my bar mitzvah?
I want.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish Our Guest this morning, Seth Rudetsky, hosts one of the most entertaining and maybe the only great show about Broadway on Sirius XM. He has a new book out. Of his own experiences, I guess deep and profound and entertaining knowledge of Broadway, his third book of sort of notes about Broadway. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Hi, thank you.
So I have a very important question that's been, my daughter and I have been debating fiercely. What's the most Jewish Broadway show?
Well, I don't know how you define Jewish.
Well, you know, there's always been a long debate. You know, what makes something Jewish music? Is it any music done by Jews? Does that mean that White Christmas qualifies since Irving Berlin wrote it? You know, is it Fiddler on the Roof? Is it March of the Falsettos? Good question.
I mean, obviously, Fiddler is all about Jewish people, but it's also kind of anti-tradition in a sense. It's really saying that Jewish tradition, I mean, has to change, so maybe some people will find that anti-Jewish. I 100% don't have an answer.
It's funny, she votes for Fiddler on the Roof and I vote for March of the Falsettos. You know more about Broadway than almost anybody, partly from having been a music director, performer off-Broadway. How do you decide what you actually talk about when you're writing about your inside knowledge?
Oh, well, the book is really, it's really a compilation of what I do every week, and every week I'm always either working with Broadway stars, I am working with Broadway stars and I'm interviewing them. So it's not like I'm deciding, it's like I just literally do a recap of what I did that week. So I'm not, because it's a compilation of all my Playbill. I write for Playbill, and every week I have to write a column of what I've done that week. So I just compile them all into these books. So just, you know, every week I'm doing concerts with, you know, I work a lot with Audra McDonald and with Pat of the Pones. So I'll talk about what happened during the concert or something funny that happened. And then I do interviews every week for Sirius XM. So if I have Vanessa Williams on, I'll do a recap of that. So it's really just whatever happened to happen that week. And basically my whole week is all Broadway. So everything in the book is all Broadway.
When did you fall in love with Broadway?
My parents, when I lived on Long Island near New York City, and instead of taking a vacation for the December break, they decided to stay on Long Island and use the money for tickets to Broadway shows. So we saw three Broadway shows. It was back in the 70s, the original run of Grease, original run of Pippin. But the one that really stayed with me was actually probably the biggest flop of them all. It was a revival of the Pajama Game, which only lasted for a month. It was a very short revival with Hal Linden and Cap Calloway and Barbara McNair. But I just was obsessed with it. And I went home and I listened to the original cast album, and I completely became obsessed with Broadway because of that little production of the Pajama Game that bombed on Broadway, but it really set me obsessed with it. And then on top of that, my parents love all music, and this is the days when people would play records and there were no headphones, so they would just play cast albums all the time, and they were always playing specifically this one show called The Most Happy Fella, and I listened to that all the time as a toddler.
That Standing on the Corner is from that show?
Standing on the Corner.
Watching all the girls go by, right.
Exactly. So I listened to that all the time as a toddler, so that music got in my head, but actually seeing it live was the Pajama Game. So I guess the music of The Most Happy Fella, and then seeing the pajama game were the two things, and then I just became completely obsessed.
We will talk much more Broadway with Seth Rudesky when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes store as very popular Jewish podcast top 10 in North America, according to Moment magazine. You know, one of the most beautiful songs from the classic musical Fiddler on the Roof, really a very Jewish musical, is the sad and lovely Far From the Home I Love.
How can I hope to make you understand why I do what I do? Why I must travel to a distant land far from the home I love? Once I was happily content to be as I was, where I was, close to the people who are close to me, here in the home I love. Who could see that a man would come who would change the shape of my dreams? Helpless now I stand with him, watching older dreams grow dim. Oh, what a melancholy choice this is, wanting home, wanting him, closing my heart to every hope but his, leaving the home I love. There where my heart has settled long ago,
that was Far From the Home I Love from the musical Fiddler on the Roof. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the issue of the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital and the location of the embassy, the U.S. embassy, and potentially other foreign embassies. Guatemala is going to move its embassy to Jerusalem. That will definitely change the balance of world power. But talk a little bit about what's involved in moving an embassy. This is a significant enterprise.
Okay, I think there have always been a few embassies of relatively smaller countries, not to be demeaning or politically incorrect about
Guatemala. I apologize to the Guatemalans who are listening right now.
Relatively small countries have always, there's always been a few with embassies in Jerusalem recognizing Israel's claim that Jerusalem is the capital and recognizing the fact that the parliament, the Knesset, the foreign ministry, and lots of other key interlocutors for embassies are located in Jerusalem, not in Tel Aviv. So let's get some definitions because a lot of people have trouble with these things. Normally, an embassy of one country, country X, say, in country Y. So let's say the embassy of Switzerland in Belgium is in the capital. And if it's a geographically large country like the United States or the Russian Federation or Australia, country X may have several consulates in country Y so that they can serve local populations in Perth, for example, without making them fly all the way to Canberra. And of course, you want to have a consulate in Sydney because it's a big business center and there are lots of American tourists who get into trouble there and lose their passports, and you want to provide consular services to those people. So sometimes people will say, oh, Russia has an embassy or France has an embassy in Boston. No, it's a consulate.
Consulate, right.
And what they have in New York is a consulate and or the French mission to the United Nations, which is not a diplomatic mission accredited to the United States, but rather, in many cases, a separate building with a delegation accredited to the United Nations, which has its General Assembly in New York. Okay, so that's essentially the difference between an embassy and a consulate, but they also do different kinds of work. Oh, and one more point on terminology. People often confuse the ambassador's residence with the embassy itself. And this stems from British novels and old fiction and movies where they talk about the embassy, but what they're really talking about is the ambassador's home, which also has extraterritoriality and which is protected by the same Geneva Convention that protects embassies, but it is the ambassador's residence and not the embassy of the United States or France or whatever.
Just clarify that term, extraterritoriality, means the laws of that country don't necessarily apply within the embassy itself or within the ambassador's residence.
Well, and above that, if a kid is born in the U.S. embassy in France or the U.S. ambassador's residence, for that matter, and not in a local hospital in Paris, that kid is born on U.S. soil and therefore has every right to American citizenship as the same as if he or she were born in Kansas City, okay? And cannot be drafted into the French army or whatever because they have no right to a French passport. And that's an important part of extraterritoriality as well. Although that varies a little bit from country to country. Anyway, point here is that moving an embassy is not that hard, and it might make logistical sense and save time and money to conduct embassy business for the United States from Jerusalem instead of driving up from Tel Aviv all the time. But nonetheless, our embassy in Tel Aviv goes on a quite regular basis to Jerusalem to deal with its government interlocutors, and those functions are not performed by the gigantic U.S. consulate in Jerusalem.
And that gigantic fortified consulate was built by a previous administration that promised to move the embassy to Jerusalem, but never did it. Well, we will see what happens from now on. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivinon, Israel Oshrat Bariel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We started talking last weekend for Martin Luther King weekend about racism in Israel. We know about it in America, still very much alive. And in Israel, we talked about the sort of the different Jewish ethnicities and sub-ethnicities, you know, from the original Ashkenazim who came all the way up through the Ethiopians, basically the most recent immigration. Of course, in Israel, the Jews mix together, and pretty soon you end up with something much more like a melting pot. There's other forms of racism in Israel too, though.
Yes.
I know the ideal is it's not like that.
Yes, I wish I could call it like differently, but there is like gaps between how Jews, you know, perceive like Arabs, and we're talking about Arabs who really live with us. There is Christian Arabs, and there is Muslim Arabs, and there is Bedouin, and there is Druze, and there is a lot of other minorities in Israel. And what is Jews, you know, think about them, and how they perceive them, and how it's impact, you know, the whole this dead end discussion we have. That's one. And of course, Palestinian who lives, you know, in the territories and in Gaza.
Right.
So this is like different, you know, because this I would say, they're I can not, say that they are more enemies. They are enemies, you know, for
right.
most of the Israelis, they are our enemies.
They're perceived as enemies, right?
They are most of them, or some of them, you know, I don't know if it's most of them, but some of them who decide to live there. I don't know if they have really a choice, but to live there, they probably, some of them agree with Hamas charter and with, you know, which does not even acknowledge our right to exist as a Jewish state. So that's why it's really different. But
so and the distinction between what in Israel they call Israeli Arabs, right, who are citizens and vote,
they're citizens
and have representatives in Knesset and so on, and sometimes they're considered, they're thought to be second-class citizens. There's definitely some distinctions. And the people who are sometimes from the same clan, frankly, who live across the border in the West Bank or Gaza, who really are not Israeli Arabs and are treated, you know, are thought of in a very different way.
It's really, I would rather talk about Arabs who lives in Israel.
Sure.
And sure. Because it's like, it's so different. Arabs who lives in Israel, you know, I feel that there is two entry points to the Israeli society. You know, if you have matriculation exam, you know,
right,
if
you bagrut.
Bagrut, you know, right. You have your finals, you know, you can go to the university, but more important is the army.
Right.
So if you served at the army, it's like, it's really the melting pot, you know, no matter where you came, what your background, how much money your parents, you have the same opportunities and, you know, the sky's limit after it.
It's a meritocracy.
And it give you an hechsher, you are part of the Israeli society. So some of the Israeli Arabs, you know, they can volunteer. You know, the Bedouin, for like they are like very important in terms of being gashashim, being the one who, I don't know, how do you say gashash? They use their smell.
Yeah, they're the scouts or the yes. Scouts, really.
And the Druze, definitely very loyal, and they are serving in the army. So, and if you go to an Arab village or to a Druze village, you will see the difference. You know, I don't know if like the Israel government would like me to say that, but you will see the difference because there is, because the Druze are really part of the Israeli society. Their leadership, you know, declare that we are part of the Mamlacha, we are part of Israel, we believe in
part
Israel,
of the
this
state,
is
right?
Our country. And therefore, I don't know, they are much well being represented in the Knesset and you know, they're
well,
more
and,
willingness
and
to...
They've been major generals and, you know, they've achieved
yes.
all kinds of high status within
yes.
the society.
Yes.
And in business as well.
Yes. Yes, you know, even among the Arabs, when we say Arabs, well, we have different categories and they're being treated differently, I would say.
And, you know, it's natural in society for different people to be treated differently. The hope is that people are treated not as a group, but as individuals.
Nahon.
And I know that's the goal of Israeli society, just as it should be the goal of American society. Thanks so much, Ashrat. We'll talk next week.
Toda rabba.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Bernie was unfortunate enough to be hit by a truck. He ended up in the ICU unit at the hospital, fighting for life. His best friend Morris came to visit him. Bernie struggled to tell Morris, "My wife Sadie visits me 3 times a day. She's so good to me every day. She reads to me at my bedside." "And what does she read to you?" asked his friend Morris. And Bernie answered, "My life insurance policy." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Journeys are centrally important in Judaism. The act of leaving and heading out into the great unknown is crucial for us. At some level, the proper theme song for Jews seems like it ought to be On the Road Again. Repeatedly, in Jewish tradition, great leaders or even the whole of our people head into the wilderness to seek God and make a new life somewhere else. It happened first with Abraham in the Torah portion of Lech Lecha. It happens 2 generations later with Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel and is in most ways the founder of our people. It happens again with Moses, who flees his country of birth in Egypt to find God in the Sinai Desert, then leaves there to go back to Egypt, and finally takes the whole people of Israel out of slavery in this week's portion of Beshalach and puts us on the path to redemption and freedom. And it keeps happening throughout Jewish history. The idea of the wandering Jew has ideological relevance as well as pathos. Wandering seems to be something we need to do, not just something we're forced to do. In particular, Jewish religious tradition has a peculiar perspective on the events of the Exodus, which reach a climax in this week's portion of Beshalach. It's true that the drama of Jewish history really begins with the story of the Exodus from Egypt and the escape from Pharaoh on the shore of the Sea of Reeds. And it's logical we focus on that, but in our prayers, practices, and traditions, we raise up the escape from slavery and heading out into the Sinai wilderness to the highest conceivable historical status, beyond even what seems to be appropriate. You know, it's not just the way we make Passover a central holiday. Well and good. A festival of freedom should be focally important, but We remind ourselves of this Exodus far more often than that. Every Friday night when we say Kiddush, we declare that we observe the Sabbath, Zecher Letziat Mitzrayim, in remembrance of the Exodus from Egypt. Which is scarcely true, since according to our own Torah, the Shabbat goes back to God's creation of the world long before the Exodus. We focus on this great narrative and its denouement in nearly obsessive ways. Why? Perhaps because, in effect, our central Jewish story is about transition, travel, hitting the road. It's a core narrative of Judaism. To paraphrase Descartes, we left, therefore we are. Our essential nature as a people is formed by this Exodus. When we find ourselves in slavery, whether physical, psychological, or moral, we must, as Jews, choose to leave. And seeing how our ancestors did it, against all odds, in order to find a new life of freedom and covenant with God, well, that can inspire us today to do so once again. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, the extraordinary Seth Radetzky, will tell us everything we don't know about Broadway musicals and the current state of the great art form, good and bad. Find out when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spent last week in India, first Israeli leader to do so in 15 years. He had direct and cordial bilateral talks with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, reciprocating the visit Modi paid to Israel last July. The trip highlights the increasingly positive and strong relationship between Israel and India. Netanyahu brought along an entire contingent of Israeli businessmen and women as commercial and military ties between the two countries continue to expand. At a business summit, Netanyahu said the partnership between Israel and India is reaching unprecedented heights, and the possibilities are boundless. Israel is an innovation nation. India is an innovation nation. The two innovation nations must come together to define the future. Hoo-ha. In a truly touching moment near the end of the trip, in Mumbai, 11-year-old Moshe Holtzberg joined Prime Minister Netanyahu during his visit to the Chabad house there. Moshe's father, Rabbi Gavriel Holtzberg, and mother, Rivka, were killed at the Nariman house during the horrifying 2008 Mumbai terror attacks by Islamist terrorists. Moshe Holtzberg has been raised in Israel since his parents were killed in India, and he showed Netanyahu where his room had been in the Chabad house. In other news, Capitol Hill police arrested 82 Jewish clergymen and women and other activists in the rotunda of the Russell Senate office building last week. They were protesting President Trump's attempt to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, that protects 800,000 immigrants from imminent deportation and provides them with a pathway to citizenship. Activists for various Jewish groups, including the Religious Action Center, the RAC of Reform Judaism, the Anti-Defamation League, Bend the Ark, Jewish Action, and TRUA, were there to demand immediate passage of the DREAM Act, legislation that would protect nearly 800,000 Dreamers in the U.S. Last week, the Justice Department said it would ask the Supreme Court to overturn a judge's recent ruling that blocked President Trump's move to end DACA. Religious leaders of many faiths and denominations have been among the many vehement opponents of Trump's decision to end DACA. In November, 15 Christian leaders and activists were arrested at the Senate office building for calling for the passage of the DREAM Act. Rabbi Jonah Pesner, director of the RAC of Reform Judaism and a past guest of Two Jewish, was among the clergy arrested. "This is no time for business as usual," he said. "In the Torah, we are called 36 different ways to love the stranger, orphan, and widow. We were strangers in the land of Egypt. We know what it means to be turned away from places we thought of as home. Today, we say there is no more time to waste. We insist that dreamers be recognized as the Americans they are." The Trump administration, in other news, froze more than half the funding for the UNRWA, the UN organization assisting Palestinian refugees and their descendants, citing what it depicted as the oversized U.S. role in funding. The U.S. State Department said last week it had put a hold on $65 million of the $125 million now due to the UNRWA, which distributes its assistance in the Gaza Strip and West Bank, as well as to refugee camps in Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. President Donald Trump and Nikki Haley, U.S. ambassador to the U.N., threatened in recent weeks to cut the funds after the Palestinian Authority walked away from an attempt to revive the peace talks in the Middle East, citing, among other factors, Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. However, State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert, announcing the cut to the UNRWA, said the decision had more to do with what the Trump administration sees as an imbalance in the U.S. contributions. Our main point is asking other countries to step up to the plate, not asking the U.S. to be the single largest donor, she said. Asking other nations to increase funding for international endeavors is consistent with many other Trump administration initiatives, notably demanding greater non-U.S. funding for the NATO alliance. Last year, the U.S. paid about 30% of the UNRWA's funding, $370 million, more than twice the second largest donor, the European Union. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu has said that long-term UNRWA's mission should be transferred to other agencies, but he has stopped short of endorsing an immediate cut in funding. Israeli security officials see the agency's role as critical, preventing a collapse of Palestinian society, particularly in the Gaza Strip. Israel continues to develop infrastructure in wonderful ways. The first high-speed train in Israel had a successful trial last week. Israel Katz, the Israeli transportation minister, promises it will be operational by this Passover, Pesach. The new electric train will take passengers from Jerusalem to Ben-Gurion Airport and then on to Tel Aviv, eventually finishing its run in Herzliya, the tech center in North Tel Aviv. Will be called the King David Line, run at over 100 miles an hour, and speed passengers from Tel Aviv to the capital city in just 28 minutes. That's faster than it often takes to go from its Jerusalem terminal near the central bus station to the outskirts of the city at high traffic. Israel has been developing its train and light rail network to ease traffic congestion in the dense population corridors of Jerusalem and the coastal strip, and this is the latest and greatest of those efforts. We look forward to riding on the high-speed King David Line soon. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish Art guests this morning, Seth Rudetsky, who hosts a fantastic show on SiriusXM on Broadway and has his third book of columns, information, backstory about Broadway out right now. Is there anything that you don't write about that you hear about?
I mean, once in a while people will be on to me and they'll be like, this cannot go into your column. But if they don't say that, then it basically goes into my column. You know, like Norm Lewis. I'm working with Norm Lewis. He just supported me in Best a couple of years ago. And he's supposed to do a big concert for me, and he just called me and he said, you can't do it because you got a Broadway show. And I was like, oh my God, what show? And he's like, you can't reveal what it is. And I was like, fine. So, like, you know, sometimes they'll tell me I can't say anything. But if they don't tell me I can't say anything, then I'll say it. There you have it.
What's the most exciting new trend on Broadway now, in your view?
Most exciting new trend. I think certainly, you know, Lin Miranda, in the sense that there's such a really current sound on Broadway. It's like there really hadn't been a current sound. I mean, Rent was sort of, but it sounded like, in a lot of ways, like music in the 70s. It wasn't necessarily like a 90s sound when you listen to Rent. It's kind of the same rock that we were playing in the 60s and 70s, but definitely In the Heights and Hamilton has much more like it literally sounds like a pop song. So the fact that pop music can be on Broadway and still advance the plot, like a lot of times they'll have pop songs on Broadway in jukebox musicals and the lyrics just like completely don't make sense and it's completely shoved in there. Whereas Lin's able to have a real pop sound like a radio song and yet the lyrics will advance the plot. So I think that it's great. It's really making Broadway, you know, relevant, as they say.
There's a very funny bit in Spamilton where they talk about how Hamilton has made Broadway for straights again.
I don't actually, I think it actually makes me crazy. The whole straight and gay Broadway really infuriates me, and I think it's what's destroying our country. Like, literally, the whole destruction of the arts is all because the arts are considered gay and people hate gay people. So all the unfunding of the arts, the hating the NEA, is all because of this myth that Broadway is gay, when actually Broadway is an American art form and it's for everybody. George Gershwin is straight, Irving Berlin, Ed Sullivan. I don't know where the myth began that's for gay people, but it actually infuriates me. And it's literally what I feel is destroying the country and destroying the arts, because we're losing an entire generation of arts because we've cut we've cut so much in schools now. It's completely cut. I'm in New York City. I'm volunteering to be a chorus teacher because my daughter's high school on the wealthy Upper West Side doesn't have a chorus teacher. And it's all because of this, like, the arts are for gay people. So it's like, I completely 100% don't subscribe to that way of thinking. I think it's ruining the country.
You said many important things, but one is Broadway musicals are an American art form. Is it the most distinctive American art form?
Art, in terms of art, I don't know if it's the most distinctive, but I'd say it's probably the most world famous. I wouldn't say, like, American folk art is necessarily world famous. And, folk music is... Folk music kind of sounds the same, and this French folk music I like kind of sounds like American folk music. I'd say it's probably the most distinctive, but really, in a sense, really, musicals were precursors. The precursor was Gilbert and Sullivan. They're very similar to our current Broadway musicals. So, in a sense, there's probably a British art form that we've sort of put our own stamp on.
So, from opera to light opera to Broadway musical.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Light opera really, I mean, opera, the lyrics are horrible. It's just like, I want to go outside over and over again, like, outside. But, like, light opera, the lyrics really can't plot. You know, it makes it crazy because I went to Oberlin and it was such snobbery about opera. And I'm like, I don't understand why you're proud of, like, something that is. Like a 3-year-old wrote it. Like, where? Like, there's no skill for libretti. It drives you up the wall. Whereas operetta, I mean, Gilbert and Sullivan lyrics are hilarious.
Oh, they're brilliant. So, the lyrics. Yeah. Gilbert's lyrics are brilliant.
And the music is fantastic. You said it's all in the style of light opera. So American made the music more popular.
Fascinating. All right, I'm gonna throw one more, canard stereotype. This one from Spamalot. You know, you can't succeed on Broadway if you don't have any Jews.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. There are, I mean, listen, for all my saying Broadway's not for gay people, I mean, the reality is many, many gay people, I mean, majority of men on Broadway, I'd say, are gay that at least work on the performing side of it. I'd say, you know, not like 99%, but I'd say like, you know, 55%, let's say, same thing on the creative side. And definitely on the Jewish side, there just happens to be more Jewish creators, it seems, of Broadway. And that's, you know, I never know. You know, you have to really do a clear scientific experiment where you have to, you know, you have to take out variables. Like, I have no idea what the answer is. I know music and arts is very much valued in the Jewish culture, but I don't know enough about other cultures to say whether it's valued in that. I mean, you know, interestingly, like, in Asian cultures, you know, you appreciate music and art, but you're not really allowed to pursue it. Like, my ex-boyfriend was Chinese-American, and I was like, oh, yeah, you have to, like, study music, but, like, you're not allowed to get a job in the music field. Whereas I think maybe in the Jewish culture, you're allowed to not only appreciate the arts, but you're allowed to pursue the arts. So maybe that's why they're more Jews? I don't know.
I think there's also the possibility that the Jews couldn't succeed for a long time in more classical fields because they were barred from it. And so they invented things like Broadway in the same way that they were barred from other aspects of art and invented comic books. It was an opportunity.
That's the whole thing also about banking, that they were, well, right. In terms of, like, they were actually allowed to bank, whereas other people weren't. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I write a book. I can totally see that being true.
Okay, tricky question. Who were your most influential performers? Who do you love the best?
Oh, influential, I could totally say. I mean, I definitely, you know, grew up in the world of television. So influence-wise, I was very much influenced by, like, Lucille Ball and Carol Burnett in terms of just performing-wise. In terms of music, certainly Leonard Bernstein, the I'm not a composer at all, but just the multifacetedness of him is something I've always really enjoyed because, you know, I'm a writer, but I'm also a performer, and I'm a musician and radio host, and I really enjoy having lots of different aspects, and that's what Leonard Bernstein would do. So he was a big idol of mine. And also George Gershwin. The two of them are similar to me in the sense that they both are classical musicians and also popular musicians, and that I have a classical piano degree from Oberlin, but obviously I work on Broadway. So they were very influential to me. And then in terms of performers, the voices that I, you know, grew up with idolizing were Andrew McArdle. Basically, in my generation, was obsessed with Andrew McArdle. And to me, it was also Pat of the Pone was, you know, Evita, just, which, by the way, I got from my bar mitzvah, you'll be happy to know.
I'm glad to hear that. It's great.
Yes, my friend Alan Hahn got it from my bar mitzvah, the two record set. I completely flipped out. So Pat of the Pone was a big obsession of mine. Chita Rivera was a big obsession of mine growing up. So, I mean, like, those are some of the answers, but it was just Broadway was, like, was my obsession. Also, of course, you know, the ultimate Jewish entertainer, Barbara Streisand. It's just, her voice was just so unbelievable and so different. I was obsessed with her.
I'm always amazed at the level of talent in any Broadway show from, I mean, everyone. you know, the guy who comes in and would be called a spear carrier in an opera, but, you know, the woman who has maybe one line is in the chorus and yet sings better and dances better than anybody in most towns in America. It's a tough field. It's a tough place to make it.
Yeah, it is a tough place to make it. I mean, yeah, it's a tough place to get to a high level. It's like if you're talented, you'll work in theater for sure. And you're probably, if you're a dancer who sings well, you'll definitely get Broadway shows, most probably. But in terms of, like, quote unquote, making it, that's where it's extremely difficult, because it's really hard to get an audition in the first place. There's just many reasons why people are kept out of auditions, and then you have to actually audition well, which most people really don't. And then you have to, you know, have a unique something that gets you the role, and then, you know, the role has to have something that stands out, and the show has to last. I mean, there's so many elements you have to get past to be known as a performer. So, yeah, it is extremely difficult, but it's also really fun. I mean, as long as you have somewhere that you can kind of make money the whole time you're doing it, and, you know, the fact that I play piano really served me very well. As long as you have a way that you can make money the whole time, then it's not as stressful. But if you're really relying only upon theater to make money, it's very, very difficult.
Josh Logan was once asked, the famous director, a musical director, when do you know that a show is going to be good? And he said, it's when a writer rolls over one morning and says, oh, I've got this idea. Do you agree that the book is the whole thing?
I don't know if the book is the whole thing, but certainly when shows don't do well, it has to do with the book in a lot of ways. Like, I mean, I talk about this in my radio show. There's so many just amazing shows with amazing scores that didn't do well. I mean, I'm always saying just because the show closed on Broadway doesn't mean you shouldn't get the CD, because they're just great, just really great music out there. But for whatever reason, the whole show didn't come together, and a lot of that has to do with, it's not that book writers thought, but the book writer, it's more that the book writer really has a very important job to make the show make sense. And so I don't know if it's the director's responsibility. The director has to say to the book writer, this doesn't make sense, you've got to fix it, or this has to be better. It's more the director than I would say the book. Hmm. Because the director has to say, this is not working, can you fix this? And worst comes to worst, you bring in another writer.
Is there a show that's really been neglected that you really think people should know about, listen to, help revive?
Well, there are lots of shows. And I have one of my very first book was called The Two Guides to Broadway. And I was like, you know, 10 shows you've never heard of, the CDs you should have. And, you know, obviously a lot of people had heard of them. But I would just say, I mean, like, just CD-wise, shows that I love, like the British cast of Snoopy, I'm obsessed with. I put A New Brain on that list. Of course, not a lot more people know A New Brain. A show that I think should be revived, I really love, was Shenandoah.
Oh, yeah. That
was so great.
I saw that with John Raitt, maybe? I don't know, a million years
John
ago.
John Cullum.
That's it. That's right.
He was fantastic. And it's like, I always think Hugh Jackman should do that again. I think it's a great show. And it's not done very often, but it's really moving with great music.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of shows out there, and schools just kind of seem to do the same shows over and over again, and I just think there are a lot more shows to choose from.
I vote for Shenandoah, because I always loved that. There's that song Violets and Silver Bells, and that's beautiful.
Yeah,
music.
Oh yeah, and I've heard it all before. And
Freedom really actually cool. Is a nice song too.
I love Freedom.
Yeah,
I love Why Was I? Why am I me? Why am I me? Why am I me?
Really right.
Great,
yeah.
Songs.
Absolutely. What show has been wildly successful that you don't like very much, and can you say that?
I mean, the one show I will talk about, I don't really like being negative about anything, because there's something for everyone. And I'll say Mamma Mia, and not based on this is stupid, that is stupid. Mamma Mia has really set the stage for a lot of shows in terms of, it's this British thing of not having an orchestra. They had a 9-person band, and they've changed, people's ears are getting accustomed to horrific synthesizers over microphone and completely changing the sound of what Broadway is. So yeah. Mamma Mia had a 9-person band, and on top of that, it had all this pre-recorded music, so many of the background vocals were pre-recorded. So it attuned people's ears, probably just to save money. It wasn't like for any other reason except for to save money. And it sounds like a theme park. And it just infuriated me that the critics weren't over the top of saying, you cannot bring this type of sound to Broadway. You can't bring a 9-person band with pre-recorded singing. And pre-recorded, by the way, orchestra moments. It was really a saxophone solo, because I had to play in that pit where I would, during Waterloo, where I would push a button on my synthesizer and it would play the saxophone solo. And then I would push another button and it would play the background music for Take a Chance, Take a Chance, Take a Chance. So that is infuriating to me because they're making millions and millions of dollars, and instead of spending it on having an actual Broadway sound with a delicious full orchestra, it was in the same theater where West Side Story was, 30-piece orchestra, and had a 9-person band. So that's the kind of thing that is infuriating. It's not. I love ABBA. I mean, I think the music is amazing. But that kind of cheapness and the fact that the critics haven't been calling out shows like that, that every revival that keeps coming back, they'll have half the orchestra. This horrific sound is infiltrating Broadway. All the new Broadway shows have this new chamber band sound. It's 9 pieces plus a string quartet. It's this new stupid sound, which they're claiming is in the style of the show. And it's like, no, it's not in the style of the show. You're saving money. And it's making Broadway have this stupid, tinny, thin sound. And then when a show like South Pacific comes back with a 30-piece orchestra, they're like, wow, it sounds amazing. It's like, wait, it sounds the way every Broadway show
should sound. I think it's a great, great point. Last quick question. I feel like we could talk a lot about Broadway. Amplified sound. Everybody's wearing a mic. Everybody's got that little mic above their head or next to their face, next to their mouth. It's changed singing on Broadway too, hasn't it?
Yeah, so interesting. It's like I began in the day, I saw Broadway shows where there were just floor mics. And it's like, I can't even remember what that sounded like. I mean, I can't imagine what it sounded like before mics at all. Like, I'm fascinated. I wish someone could build a theater and be like, this is what it sounded like with a full orchestra and no mic at all. Dying to hear what that sounded like. I have no idea. But I saw Annie S. of course on shows that just had 4 mics, and I heard those shows great. And now I remember I was in college during Les Mis, and that was a big deal because Leeds used to have body mics, but during Les Mis, they're like, everybody in the cast has a body mic, and I was like, what? Oh my God. And now that's just de rigueur. I don't know if it's changed singing, but like I said, it's changing our ears to kind of. Yeah, except this kind of electronic sound. You know, it really depends on the sound designers. There are great sound designers out there that can make it sound kind of natural and acoustic, and there are other sound where it sounds very electronic. So it varies from show to show. But it is depressing that it's sounding more like a rock concert and less like the natural voice, which is so thrilling.
I want to thank Seth Rudesky for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Seth, where can people go to find out more about your book and to get it?
Well, if you look up my name, Seth, if you look up Seth in Broadway, you'll probably just find a million things, because my last name is a headache to remember to spell, but my last name is Rudesky.
It's so a good Jewish name. Now, come on.
If you have the koyach to try to figure out how to spell it, Rudesky, good luck. It's with a Y at the end. And you can listen to me on SiriusXM. You can look on my website, SethRudesky.com. But just look up Seth Broadway. You'll see tons of videos and books and this and that.
Thank you so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Emily Wanderer Cohen, child and grandchild of Holocaust survivors, whose work with second and third generation survivors has led to an exceptional process of writing out trauma. Her new book is called From Generation to Generation, Healing Intergenerational Trauma Through Storytelling. And of course, listen to all our podcasts on iTunes and at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from a Broadway musical, of course, Barbara Streisand singing Don't Rain on My Parade from Funny Girl. Why not? My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of peace.
Don't tell me not to live, just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade. Don't tell me not to fly, I simply got to. If someone takes a spill, it's me and not you. Who told you you're allowed to rain on my parade? I'll march my band out, I'll beat my drum. I guess I didn't make it, but whether on the rose of sheer perfection or freckle on the nose of life's complexion, the cinder or the shiny apple of its eye, I gotta fly once, I gotta try once, only can die once bright.
'cause I'm a comer. I simply gotta march, my heart's a drummer. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade. I'm gonna live and live now. Get what I want, I know how. One roll for the whole shebang.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.